That lines President Raisi in an address to a regional economic summit. U.S. sanctions will not hamper Iran's interaction with its neighbors. Australia joins a growing list of countries where cases of South Africa's new coronavirus variant are being detected. And 4 months into his presidency, Peru's Castillo is facing calls to step down and a congressional push for his impeachment. Our top story for this half hour. President Ebrahim Raisi assures Iran's neighbors that Washington's sanctions will have no bearing on regional cooperation and interaction.
The United States' cruel sanctions against Iran will not have the slightest impact on the Islamic Republic of Iran's policy of maximum interaction with neighboring and regional countries.
Raisi, who is in Turkmenistan's capital, Ashgabat, to attend a summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization, called on member states to work together in a range of fields, from the creation of a regional electricity market to water transfer projects as well as energy ventures. He said Iran is ready to help connect the fiber optic networks of member states as well as promote artificial intelligence projects and virtual education programs. President Raisi also proposed that the organization create an internal financial mechanism to boost its efficacy. Parties to the 2015 nuclear deal are preparing for talks scheduled for Monday. Now Iran's negotiating team is holding bilateral and trilateral meetings in Vienna. The Iranian team held talks at the expert level with the heads of the Russian and Chinese teams, as well as EU coordinator Enrique Mora. The signatories to the deal are set to resume talks after a five-month break. Iran says it won't settle for anything less than U.S. sanctions removed all at once in a verifiable manner. Iran also wants strict guarantees that the U.S. would not abandon the agreement again. The U.S. imposed many rounds of sanctions on Iran after pulling out of the 2018 accord. Homa Lesgi is joining us now from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, tell us more about preparations for the talks and also about the mood and atmosphere leading into this recent round of revival talks.
As you said, preparations are well underway for the joint commission meeting that's expected on Monday, tomorrow, at the Hotel Coburg. That is, of course, the venue that a lot of our viewers may be familiar with, where the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was actually agreed upon and the talks concluded back in 2015. So more than 6 years now, the sides are back, of course, now at the Deputy Foreign Minister level, or the level of political directors, back to see if they can actually revive this deal, save it from utter and total collapse. If we look at the mood, you asked, a lot of political observers, commentators, if you read the news reports or comments, a lot of them say that they don't hope for any breakthrough, that it doesn't look like things are going to work out anytime soon. But there is also hope, at least we heard from the Russian ambassador here, who's quite active on Twitter when it comes to pursuing these talks, and he's also the head of the Russian delegation, Mr. Olyanov. He's saying that during the IAEA board session, all members of the board, the Europeans, Russians, Chinese, were all hopeful that these rounds of talks can help revive the deal if, of course, he was saying that the root cause of the problem is addressed. And he was referring to the U.S. withdrawal, saying it's now time to deal with that which caused the problem in the first place. But accompanying Mr. Barberi, the head of Iran's delegation, are also hearing the Deputy Economy Minister for International Affairs, the Deputy Foreign Minister for Legal Affairs, the Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Affairs, and the Deputy of Iran's Central Bank Governor. So we see here that the people, the officials who are accompanying Mr. Barberi, there is a focus, of course, on the economic aspects of compliance, because Iran has said that the new negotiating team reiterating, but in a very stronger tone, that it wants the verifiable and effective removal of all U.S. sanctions, including the additional Trump-era sanctions, unconditionally and immediately. And this is being seen by some commentators as maximalist demands, that they are of the view that the United States will not yield, because in the previous rounds of talks, there was, of course, speculation that the U.S. was not agreeing to these terms, for instance, to remove sanctions verifiably before Iran takes action, or to give a guarantee that the United States will actually not withdraw from the deal again if indeed the deal is restored. We'll have to see. I think this round of talks is basically about all the other sides. The U.S. of course indirectly involved. The U.S. will not be in the Joint Commission session, but the representative Rob Maddy is expected to be here to be in consultations with the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese and to convey their messages to Iran. I think the expectation now is for all the sides to get an understanding of the clear-cut positions of this new Iranian negotiating team and to see where this puts them. Mr. Olyanov had said earlier, the Russian ambassador, that he doesn't believe the talks should start from scratch because Iran has a new team, that the talks should resume from the point where they were cut off. So I think the idea now is to see if that is going to be possible, if there is any differences in the positions that are expressed by the new Iranian team, and how the sides can work towards, of course, what Iran's expectations are from these talks.
Thanks a lot, Omar Leisky, speaking to us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. November 27th marked the first anniversary of Israel's assassination of prominent Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. That was part of Israel's long-running objectives to hamper advancements made in Iran's nuclear program, but anti-Iran plots have proven ineffective as Tehran continues to make progress with its peaceful nuclear program.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the former head of the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated on November 27, 2020, when the car he was riding in came under attack near his countryside residence east of Tehran. Fakhrizadeh had reportedly been on Israel's hit list since at least 2007.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But he wasn't the only Iranian scientist to have been targeted by Israel. The regime made several assassination attempts between 2007 and 2012 that claimed the lives of four nuclear scientists and wounded another. That's on top of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear sites that have become more frequent over the past months. Iran has vowed to continue the work on its peaceful nuclear program. The international community, however, was largely silent over the recent assassination, a similar attitude of indifference that displayed toward Israel's airstrikes on Syria and its aggression on the Palestinian people.
The point is simple. Israel is America's most important friend and ally in the Middle East and in North Africa. Israel is exempt from prosecution in the eyes of America, simply because without Israel, America's position in the Middle East and in North Africa would be in serious jeopardy.
Iran has vowed a harsh response against those behind the attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists and sites.
American officials have reportedly warned Israel that its attacks on Iran's nuclear program will prove counterproductive. They say the regime's actions have enabled Iran to rebuild an even more efficient enrichment system. The reports say Israel has rejected the U.S. warning, saying it won't shift its anti-Iran policies. This implies that Israel may continue targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists.
A report published by the New York Times suggests that the United States has called on Israel to stop its attacks on Iran's nuclear program, suggesting that they could help strengthen Iran's capabilities. The article cites officials familiar with the discussions who said Washington has told Tel Aviv that the attacks are ultimately counterproductive, as Iran has been able to replace the damaged centrifuges with newer and much more capable ones within months. According to the article, the U.S. officials have admitted that Iran has improved its defenses, including with regard to its cybersecurity, rendering an attack similar to the Stuxnet virus extremely difficult to succeed. Israeli officials have reportedly rejected the U.S. call, saying they don't have any intention of ending their anti-Iran policies. Yet the credibility of the whole report is under question, as Washington and Tel Aviv hardly disagree on matters, especially in the case of Iran.
The Americans understand that Israel's actions often cannot be defended publicly, so it cannot always be seen in public as siding with the Israelis. So that is why from time to time the Americans will issue a public statement saying that they have issued a caveat to Tel Aviv about their actions vis-a-vis Lebanon or vis-a-vis Iran.
The report could also be a scare tactic in an attempt to obtain concessions ahead of the key talks in Vienna on the obligations of the parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. But Iran has repeatedly stated its firm position that the talks must end in the removal of all anti-Tehran sanctions.
And concerns are rising over the latest coronavirus variant called Omicron. Australia now joining the list of countries that have confirmed cases of the strain. Health officials say the strain was found after testing two passengers from Southern Africa who flew into Sydney on Saturday. The Omicron has already been detected or suspected in several countries, including the UK and Germany. It has a large number of mutations with worrying characteristics. The World Health Organization says Omicron is potentially more contagious than the previous variants. Countries are scrambling to curb its spread by enforcing travel curbs.
South African airports have become a scene of stranded passengers with cancelled flights as the world races to contain the new concerning COVID-19 variant called Omicron. While inconvenient in nature, the bans have drawn mixed reactions from people most affected by the restrictions.
I'm not happy with the situation because I booked my flight on time. Everything was on time. Now I'm inconvenienced because I had to be at work tomorrow, but then they canceled the flight. After canceling the flight, if I arrive in the UK, because I'm quarantining in Frankfurt, if I arrive in the UK after 4 p.m., I have to quarantine in a hotel on my cost for 10 days. I don't have the money. I don't have the £2,000 to quarantine in the hotel.
The countries that are banning South Africans out have higher rates than we currently do. So I don't think it's totally fair, but I get that countries are just trying to protect themselves and their citizens.
Meanwhile, South Africa, enraged by the restrictions, says it is being punished for being the first country to detect and report the strain, which the World Health Organization has termed a variant of concern.
Based upon the information that we have, particularly from South Africa, they have advised WHO that this variant should be classified as a variant of concern.
Following the discovery, several countries have not only imposed restrictions, but also locked their first cases of the Omicron variant. The British government on Saturday announced new precautionary measures after two Omicron cases were detected in the country.
We will require all contacts of those who test positive with a suspected case of Omicron to self-isolate for 10 days, regardless of your vaccination status. We will also go further in asking all of you to help contain the spread of this variant by tightening up the rules on face coverings in shops and on public transport.
Elsewhere in Europe, Germany reported two cases of the Omicron variant in the state of Bavaria. In Italy, officials registered the first case of the new strain in a traveler from Mozambique. The Czech Republic and the Netherlands have each also reported one suspected case of the new strain. Meanwhile, Hungary says it will impose restrictions on travelers from seven African countries. This comes while EU member states had already agreed to impose restrictions on all travel from South Africa. Iran halted travel from African countries including South Africa, Mozambique, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Lesotho, and Eswatini until further notice. Several other countries, including Australia, the U.S., Brazil, and Guatemala, have either forced several travel restrictions already or are set to impose such bans this week. While scientists are still learning about the variant, the news has already taken a toll on the global economy amid fears of what the new travel bans would do to the economy still reeling from its falls in 2019. Since its emergence, COVID-19, which has claimed over 5,190,000 lives out of nearly 261 million cases, has gone through several mutations. But considering the human body's ability to fight new strains of the virus and the immunity provided by vaccines, officials across the globe continue to push for jabs in the world's fight against the pandemic.
Thousands of Peruvians want President Pedro Castillo to step down, and they've marched in the streets of Lima to have their say. Castillo has been president for just over 3 months, but his popularity has been on the decline. Opposition legislators in the Congress have even presented a motion to impeach the president, arguing he's morally unfit to rule the country. The motion needs at least 52 votes from the 130-seat body to begin the impeachment proceedings, though a vote is not yet scheduled. Castillo has promised to redistribute mineral profits more evenly, but protesters say they haven't seen that happen. They're also angry at the scandals involving several of Castillo's ministers and advisors. And it's election day in Kyrgyzstan. People are heading to the polls to vote for a new parliament. There are about 3.7 million eligible voters. They'll have to choose deputies for a downsized legislature that used to have 120 members. But now only 90 seats are up for grabs. More than 1,300 candidates are vying under a new electoral system. Parties loyal to President Sadir Japarov are expected to gain the upper hand. The vote is a rerun of last year's failed election that saw the government ousted. The 2020 elections were annulled amid street protests, with the opposition claiming widespread fraud in favor of the former president. Japarov, who was serving a jail term back then, was freed from prison in the post-election unrest. The first results are expected late on Sunday. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met Heather, Josh, and Rachel. All three suffer from disability and chronic illnesses. All three are children to fathers who fought in Vietnam, and all three are victims of Agent Orange. And now they decide to embark on a journey to return to the country where their tragic story began as children of war veterans and as victims of war. Now stay with us to witness the rest of this emotional and healing journey.
My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks, and he suffered from PTSD really bad from all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive, and he was very violent, and he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks, lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they would fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave them out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and you couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them and landmines everywhere and tripwires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees. So when you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And there was, he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go and like his friend would be walking right in front of him, and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him, and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia, pictures and videos, books, that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. And when he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school. And what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village. And the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything. And the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general. And when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, "Oh, Chu Lai." And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it, and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and then I saw where they slaughtered all them women and children. And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. And there was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. It was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything that they came in contact with. I got a ride from my dad and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house. And I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something. I didn't know. So I hurried up and I pulled in the driveway and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went and I went to the side with them and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there were some people that were riding some motorcycles and they had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me, because all my life my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
War in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
Snipers out. When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started like just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975 that it's still in infancy. I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything. I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout. That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War, and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies. There was an out-of-court settlement.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath. You know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting. Come on. Nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war, who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited. Come on, something. Say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it. It's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something. Nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
These people have taken me in. Like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment, because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all of a sudden they were gonna have a flashback because they saw an American face, or I just had no idea what to expect. But after after he sat there and looked at me in my eyes for a good minute, and he came over there and he gave me a big hug, and he told me that Vietnam doesn't want war. They don't want to hate the American people, that they just want to live in peace from now on. And
now that I've come and I've been able to put faces, it's been a wonderful experience to get the second side of the story. Every conflict, every problem has two sides. I've been raised with one side of the story. Now I've gotten the second side of the story, and now I can take both those elements and put them together and formulate something to share with my children.
Just like my dad, I'm not going to lie about things when I get back to the United States and try to make it look nice or do anything. All my friends and family and stuff, I'm going to tell them how my trip was.
Once I came to Vietnam, I said, okay, this is more. This is more. This is bigger. This is bigger than Heather. Because a lot of my life was trying to deal with what happened to me. And when I came here and understood that the problem was way, way, way bigger than just me, or just a few of the kids that I had kind of connected with in the United States, I understood that I couldn't go back to just thinking of me and my story and my problems and those things. I knew I had to do more.
The Red Cross estimates that 3 million Vietnamese have been affected by dioxin, including at least 150,000 children born with serious birth defects. Millions of Americans and Vietnamese are still suffering directly and indirectly by the wartime U.S. spraying of Agent Orange and other herbicides over southern and central Vietnam. Question is, how many more generations must suffer, and how long will this deadly legacy of U.S. crimes against innocent lives linger on? Well, that's it, everyone, for this program. Remember, you can contact us through our email, or better yet, through Facebook and Twitter. Until next time, and another Aperture It's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. It's a privilege and an honor, as always, to have you guys join us again on today's episode of The Lantern. There's this famous quote that's been going around for the past 6, 7, 8 years, I think since Kung Fu Panda came out, that yesterday is history, tomorrow is mystery, and today is a gift. That's why it's called the present. And it's a very catchy, touching, once you really think about it, deep philosophical quote. And interestingly enough, there are so many ahadith from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that talk about the same thing exactly. That though the past makes us who we are today, it does not define what we must be in the future. And it most definitely isn't something that we should obsess about vigilantly, because let's listen to a short story about this, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners of this program, Lantern, so welcome. I invite you to listen to our today's story. A man who lived a long time ago believed that he could read the future in the stars. He called himself an astrologer and spent his time at night gazing at the sky. He was always busy worrying about future, and villagers often came to him hoping to know what their future holds. One evening, he was walking along the open road outside the village. His eyes were fixed on the stars. He thought he saw there that the end of the world was at near. He lost in his thoughts about the future. As he was looking at the stars, he kept walking without looking down. Suddenly, he fell into a ditch full of mud and water. He was sinking in the muddy water and madly trying to claw at the slippery sides of the hole in his efforts to climb out. He was unable to crawl out. He started screaming for help. His cries for help soon brought the villagers running. As they pulled him out of the mud, one of them said, "You pretended to read the future in the stars, and yet you fail to see what is at your feet? This may teach you to pay more attention to what is right in the front of you and let the future take care of itself." "What use is it," said another, to read the stars when you can't see what's right here on the earth? Now, moral point. We all want our future to be bright and happy, but the time doesn't stop for anyone. Each tomorrow turns into today. Your present is also a part of your future. There is always a tomorrow to look forward and improve, but you can't go back to yesterday. So maintain the balance of your present time while you work for a better tomorrow.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
You know the hadith that says, "Why does my servant worry about the provisions of tomorrow when I don't ask them for the worship of tomorrow?" I'm not mukallaf, I am not under any obligation for tomorrow's prayer or fast. If I fall and die today, Allah's not gonna ask me like, "Oh Zainab, what about, you know, Ramadan 2022? What about the fast for that?" I'd be like, "Well God, it wasn't time yet. So why am I stressing over something that hasn't happened yet? Tomorrow is filled with promises and prospects and new beginnings. It's like a new slate every single morning, because every single morning I can wake up with the intention of not sinning, doing my best not to sin at least, being mindful of my actions, my words, and my intentions. Being mindful of remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and constantly acknowledging His blessings, the things He's given me, the bounties, the provisions, the prosperity, the health, the wealth, the security that He's blessed me with. And all of these are things to look forward to, and it would help us let go of yesterday. Sometimes even yesterday we have trouble letting it go because you know, our tomorrow is just so bleak and so empty, while our yesterday is filled with memories, fond memories, and laughter and smiles, and familiar faces, and sweet smells, and we just want to hold on to that forever. But we forget that, you know, the sky is the horizon. All those memories that we look back at and that they belong to yesterday were once a tomorrow as well. So it's possible for us to recreate them or even create better things for our future with new people, new places, new faces, or just ourselves. You know, sometimes yesterday was filled with fond memories with cousins and growing up and our siblings and grandma's house and the park and family picnics and carefree days of yesteryear where we were children and we didn't have bills and mortgages and tuitions and college debts and stuff like that to pay off. And it's true, it's really nice. But if we think about what we're going through today, right now, as a growing process, and that it will be resolved sooner or later. We just have to power through this now in order to build a better future for ourselves, to own a home, to have a stable career, to have a proper education, to be able to contribute to ourselves, our religion, our society. That's again all the things that we can look forward to, and again help us let go of yesterday. Letting go doesn't necessarily mean forsaking the memory of our loved ones. But letting go means emptying our hands so we can hold new things. And also, has to be a balance, as always, because Islam really is the religion of balance. And I feel so sad and so disappointed in myself and sometimes in others when we don't understand this properly. It's not just about, you know, death and afterlife and gloom and doom. It's about balance. We're allowed to enjoy things in this world to a certain degree, and we're allowed to have fun and be happy. And as encouraged as we are to look forward to the future and not obsess about the past and practice the art of letting go, because if we obsess about it too much, that's what God is going to do to us. He's going to keep taking from us until we learn not to hold on to anything anymore, so that we can be free and we can be light. Not that God is a sadistic bully that just wants to take everything from us. No, he wants us to, you know, lighten our weight and be able to fly higher. But the balance lies in being able to not have طول الأمل, which is another concept that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam warn us about seriously, not to have far-fetched hopes. Balance. And I think at the end of the day, that just means mindfulness and being able to live in the now. Thank you so much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.